Despite the office parties, the frantic shopping, imminent travel plans, and the carols we hear everywhere around us, this may not only be the season of Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Christmas, and Santa, but one could make a case that it is also the season of atheism. Yesterday, there were prominent articles about atheism in the New York Times and the UK's Financial Times. And my guest, Richard Dawkins, debated the existence of God on the London chat show, The Sunday Edition. Friday, there was a segment on atheism on NPR's All Things Considered, and another article on Dawkins in the UK's Telegraph. The book, The God Delusion, is the number 6 bestseller on the LA Times list, number 8 on the list at the New York Times. It is also, or has recently been, number 1 at Amazon UK and Amazon Canada, and number 2 at Amazon.com. Letter to a Christian Nation by Sam Harris, another book in the tide of atheism, was recently an equally successful bestseller. A group calling itself the Rational Response Squad has launched the Blasphemy Challenge, a campaign to entice young people to publicly renounce belief in the God of Christianity. Participants who videotape their blasphemy and upload it to YouTube will receive a free DVD of The God Who Wasn't There, a number one best-selling independent documentary at Amazon.com. In the last few years, Americans have seen the dark side of religion. 9/11 brought home the extremes to which some extreme Muslims would go to defeat infidels and attain virgins. At home, we've seen assaults on the separation of church and state and attacks on the teaching of evolution or the distribution of life-saving condoms. And now it appears the godless are fighting back. Richard Dawkins holds the Charles Simonyi Chair for the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. He first came to prominence with his 1976 book, The Selfish Gene, which popularized the gene-centric view of evolution and introduced the term meme. An outspoken atheist, in January 2006, Dawkins presented a two-part documentary entitled, Against His Wishes, I Might Add, The Root of All Evil, on the UK's Channel 4. I've read that he described his newest book, The God Delusion, as probably the culmination of his campaign against religion. Welcome, Richard Dawkins.
Thank you very much.
First, two questions. One, when and or how did you become a scientist? And two, when and or how did you become an atheist?
I became a scientist, I suppose, when I went into the science stream at school at the age of about 15. And it was a bit of a drift, I must say. It wasn't really a dedicated decision. I became truly dedicated to science only when I went to Oxford as an undergraduate. I would think in my second year at Oxford. When did I become an atheist? I suppose about 16.
And the how of how you became an atheist?
I suppose it was discovering Darwinism, because I was confirmed into the Church of England at the age of 13. I then got pretty skeptical about it, but retained some respect for the argument from design, the argument that says living things especially look as though they've been designed, so they probably have been designed. I then learned the real scientific explanation for why they look as though they've been designed, and that was enough for me, that I lost my religious faith pretty much then.
Okay. Before we launch into the conversation about the God delusion and religion, is it possible for you, after all these years, to briefly explain the theory that you first introduced in The Selfish Gene? And I see your publisher has issued a 30th anniversary edition of the book this year.
Natural selection explains why living organisms are so good at what they do. That's called adaptation. And Darwin expressed natural selection at the level of the individual organism. Those individuals who survive best and reproduce most successfully pass on their hereditary attributes, the things that made them good at surviving and reproducing. In The Selfish Gene, I, in a sense, re-expressed that important truth by looking at it from the point of view of the gene and saying that individual organisms are machines used by genes to pass them on. So natural selection is the differential survival of genes, successful genes versus unsuccessful genes. Success means building survival machines, where survival machines are individual organisms. So, I mean, that wasn't a new idea, but I gave it a kind of rhetoric which seemed to cause it to catch on.
And for people who've used the term, perhaps not quite knowing exactly what it means, what is a meme?
A meme is an analog of a gene It's a unit of cultural inheritance. Whenever anything is imitated, like a tune or a clothes fashion or an artistic fashion or a catchphrase, when it's imitated, that is somewhat similar to a gene replicating itself. And to the extent that that kind of pseudo-heredity can be the basis for a quasi-Darwinian process, it needed a name and I called it a meme. Other people have had similar ideas and have given different names, like cultigen.
No wonder people know the one meme. And do you still hold to that theory as you introduced it 30 years ago, or has your thinking on that evolved over the years?
I only ever intended it as a way of downplaying the gene as the main unit of natural selection. The whole of the rest of my book, The Selfish Gene, was about the gene as the unit of natural selection, and I wanted to dramatize the point that anything in the universe that has certain properties which genes do have, namely accurate, high-fidelity copying of themselves and some degree of power or influence over their likelihood of being copied, anything that answered to those descriptions could be the basis of a form of Darwinian natural selection. If computer viruses had been invented in 1976, or if I'd known about them, I would probably have used computer virus as my example. As it was, I used memes as my example, but really, as I say, the aim was to downplay the gene. I never intended it to be a theory of human culture. Others have developed it into a theory of human culture, and I'm delighted that they've done so.
In my introduction, I cited several manifestations of what I termed the season of atheism. Now, beyond your book, what do you think explains this phenomenon?
I was delighted by your introduction, I may say. I would love to think you're right, that there really is something moving. There's a shifting in the tectonic plates, and at last, in America, atheism is becoming respectable and something that one can come out of the closet and really proclaim oneself. I do hope you're right. I got certain indications of that on my recent tour of the United States when I went right around the country promoting the God delusion. I got packed houses everywhere I went. I got standing ovations, it has to be said. Of course, I was preaching to the choir, but I was impressed by how large the choir is and how enthusiastic. And over again, people came up to me afterwards and said how grateful they were that I and Sam Harris and others were finally speaking out and saying the things that they wished they had said, saying the things that they wanted to say but perhaps didn't feel able to.
Yeah, I know that one of the things that's available on the web is your time in Virginia, in the town that also houses Liberty University. And that's a very, very fascinating, Lynchburg, yes. It's a very fascinating exchange between you and students in Lynchburg. You compare the experience of atheists today to that of gays in the fairly recent past. And do you think that's an apt comparison? And I would ask two questions. Is atheism a choice? And can people be reprogrammed?
Well, I think the parallel is a valid one. Until recently, nobody dared admit that they were gay. Now they're rather proud to do so. Nowadays, it's impossible to get elected to public office if you're an atheist, and I think that's got to change. The gay rights movement raised consciousness. It initiated the idea of gay pride. I think we've got to have atheist pride, atheist consciousness. People have got to realize that they can get, or they should be able to get elected to public office, to the Senate, to the presidency, if they are a self-proclaimed atheist. I think it's pretty clear that a fair number of members of Congress must be lying, because not a single one of them admits to being an atheist. And yet, if you look statistically at the probability that a sample of whatever it is, 535 well-educated members of American society, not one single one of them is an atheist. That statistically is highly unlikely. So some of them at least have got to be lying. And I think it's a tragedy that they have to, and that's what we need to raise public consciousness about.
I've searched some of the media and the literature regarding the current upsurge, And could you address a couple of reactions that I see, either to atheism in general, to you, to your book, and so on, okay? One, people ask, why are atheists so angry?
Well, they're not really very angry. That's a misperception, and it's a very curious misperception. We get accused of being angry, we get accused of being intolerant. But if you were to look at, say, critiques of one political party by the other, say when Democrats criticize Republicans or Republicans criticize Democrats, nobody ever says you're being intolerant of Republicans or angry. It's just normal, robust argument. The thing about religion is that people have got so used to the idea that religion must be immune to criticism that even a very mild and gentle criticism of religion comes across as angry and intolerant. That's yet another piece of consciousness raising that we've got to undertake.
Okay, another. You and others are accused of being arrogant, condescending.
Well,
what do you say to that?
Exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. Nobody says that somebody, that a Democrat who dismisses Republican ideas is arrogant. They just assume, well, that's what politicians do. They attack each other's ideas, and they do so with good, robust give and take. That's exactly what people like me and Sam Harris are doing with respect to religion. Once again, the accusation of arrogance comes about because religion has acquired this weird protection that you're not allowed to criticize it, and therefore even mild criticism comes across as arrogance.
You know, I must correct a perception of yours, I think. I think you give the Americans too much credit. And perhaps it's similar to what you're saying, but in the last couple of years, or maybe since 9/11, when people have criticized the Bush administration, they are accused of Bush-hating. And I think it's because they were attempting to clothe this president and this administration in the same kind of protective halo that religion has had.
That's a very interesting thought. Now that you mention it, I have noticed that very thing. There has been a tendency to say, if you criticize the president, Bush, you are criticizing America, which is so ludicrous because he was elected by a minority, and so if indeed he was elected at all, and therefore yes, I take your point completely. Thank you.
Okay, another. People finally say, "What's it to you? Why not be an atheist if you like, if that's what works for you? Leave the rest of us to be as religious as we wish." And this, I believe, is offered as a challenge to your open-mindedness or your respect for others. You're being called an atheist fundamentalist. Now, you anticipated that criticism, and you answer it in Chapter 8, and yet the critique continues.
Yes. Well, there are various things to say. One is that fundamentalist usually means goes by the book, and so a religious fundamentalist goes back to the fundamentals of the Bible or the Quran, whatever it is, and says nothing can change. Well, of course, that's definitely not the case with any scientist, and certainly not with me. So I'm not a fundamentalist in that sense. Why not live and let live? Why not just say, oh, well, people want to believe that, that's fine. Of course, I mean, nobody's stopping people believing whatever they like. The problem is that there's not that much tolerance coming the other way. Things like the opposition to stem cell research, the opposition to abortion, the opposition to contraception, these are all religiously inspired prohibitions on what would otherwise be freedom of action of people, whether it's scientists or individual human beings. There are religious people who are not content to say, oh, well, my religion doesn't allow me to use contraceptives, but I'm quite happy for anybody else to. Instead, we have religiously inspired prohibitions on aid programs abroad, including in areas where HIV/AIDS is rife, prohibiting aid going in any form that might be used to help contraception. Now, that is religion overstepping the bounds and interfering in other people's freedom. So religion does not observe this live and let live philosophy.
And in the case you cite, literally.
Exactly. So that's one reason, and that would be, I suppose, the main reason for not necessarily going along wholeheartedly with a live and let live policy.
Mm-hmm. In other words, if it were just a philosophical belief that had no impact on the world, fine.
Exactly. And any gentle religion like Jainism that does that, I don't think you'll find many people criticizing it. But the other thing is that as a scientist and as an educator, It's impossible to overlook the fact that, especially in America, there is a vigorous and virulent campaign going on to suppress the teaching of scientific biology. And that is purely motivated by religion. And in state after state, time after time, there are court battles being fought. Scientists are having to go out of the laboratory and waste their time responding to these know-nothings who are trying to stop the teaching of evolution or give equal time to creationism or intelligent design or whatever they like to call it. And so that's yet another reason for citing the intolerance of religion. They actually are trying to interfere with the freedom of children to learn science and the freedom of science teachers to teach their science properly.
Why did you write The God Delusion?
Well, I care passionately about the truth. I believe that the truth about whether there is a God in the universe is possibly the most important truth there is. I happen to think it's false, but I think it's a really important thing, and so I wanted to communicate about something as important as that. And then also because I felt that the world actually is drifting, in parts of it anyway, towards theocracy in very dangerous ways, and the education in my own field of evolutionary biology was under threat. There are all sorts of reasons why one might worry about the looming rise of religious influence, in especially in the United States of America and in the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm. I will say that when I heard you speak at Caltech, one of the thoughts I had in answer to this question or this need was that it seems to me that that sort of blockage actually may slow down our social evolution, which is where evolution will take place now, because evolution doesn't move quickly enough to save us from ourselves.
Yes, you mean non-genetic cultural evolution.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, I think you're right.
Okay, let's go into some of the arguments in the book. First, can you explain the distinction that you offer between Einstein's God, as you put it, and supernatural God? And you clarify this at the top of the book to make clear which definition of God you believe is a delusion. So could you, and in doing this, might you, if you wish, mention also something about polytheism and monotheism?
Yes. Sometimes when people hear that one is an atheist, they will say something like, oh, well, surely you believe in something, or you believe that the universe is a wonderful place. And I say, yes, of course the universe is a wonderful place. And they say, oh, well, then you believe in God. They are using God in the Einsteinian sense of a kind of metaphor for that which we find mysterious and wonderful in the universe. Without a doubt, and the more that physicists look into the origins of the universe, the more wonderful it does seem to become. Without a doubt, there is cause for something approaching worship or reverence that moves scientists such as Einstein, such as Carl Sagan, and in my humble way, myself. Einstein was very fond of using the word God, and he used the word God to refer to that feeling of non-personal reverence.
Okay, let me ask a question just because we're in a distinction here. You just said that he used it for the feeling. Didn't he also use it for the, if you will, the very existence, the very awesome existence that we confront?
Yes, he did. I mean, when Einstein wanted to say something like, could the universe have happened in any other way? Is there only one kind of universe? The way he expressed it was, did God have a choice in creating the universe? Now, to any ordinary theist, any ordinary churchgoer in the pew, that sounds as though Einstein believed in God. It sounds as though Einstein believed that a personal God designed the universe.
Yes, and perhaps they might even think he believed in their God.
Well, that would be even worse if they thought he believed in the Christian God or the Jewish God or whatever it might be. In fact, all Einstein was doing was wondering whether there could be more than one kind of universe, which is a perfectly respectable scientific question. I think it's extremely unfortunate that Einstein chose to use the word God for that. Einstein himself was most indignant when he was taken literally and people thought that he meant a personal God, such as the Christian God or the Jewish God, and he was really quite angry about that. But I think in a way he was asking for trouble by using the word God. He did it again over Heisenberg's indeterminacy principle, which he hated, and the way he expressed his hatred for it was to say, God does not play dice.
Mm-hmm. That to me is the most famous quote in which he uses the word. And so the distinction you're making is between that and the God that is the delusion is?
A personal God. A God who is a deliberate, conscious intelligence, the sort of God who listens to your prayers, forgives your sins, sits down like a master engineer or physicist and designs the universe, works out what ought to happen, worries about sins, all that kind of thing.
Right, the one that you pray to as you shoot a foul shot or go into a boxing match, yes. Could you briefly respond, as you do in the book, to some of the arguments, then, for this supernatural, directive, personal God? The argument from beauty, the argument from the awesome elegance.
Well, yes, I mean, there are people who say things like, well, if you don't believe in God, how do you account for Beethoven, then? How do you account for a lovely sunset? How do you account for Michelangelo? I mean, it's such a dopey thing to say. Beethoven wrote beautiful music. Schubert wrote beautiful music. Michelangelo painted wonderful paintings and did wonderful sculptures. Whether or not there is a God, it doesn't add to the argument one bit. So that's not an argument, although an amazingly large number of people seem to think it is.
Okay, the argument from personal experience, and I'll tell you, this took me back to my high school days in Central Florida, where my questions regarding God's existence in conversations late night with sophomores and juniors, you know, would be answered by some of my buddies with the conversation defying, you have to experience it.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that is a difficult one. But on the other hand, anybody who knows anything about psychology knows what an immensely powerful simulation engine the brain is. And I'm impressed by the fact that every single night of my life, I dream, and my brain conjures up images and sounds of things that have never existed and never will exist. They're completely nonsensical. It's as though I go temporarily insane every night of my life, and you do too, everybody does. We get a very, very lifelike, full-color simulation, computer simulation, of a fantasy world inside our heads. Now, when we get that in our sleep, we call it a dream. When we get it in much less vivid form in our waking lives, we might call it a still small voice, or a vision of God, or a vision of an angel, or God just talks to me, which is much more what your college friends would have said. I don't suppose many of them claim to have actually seen angels. I took that as a more extreme example. One or two people do claim that. Even when you actually see an angel, even when you actually hear a voice inside your head, that is an easy feat of simulation for the brain to achieve. And when it's just a sort of vague feeling that God is talking to you or God is whispering to you, then, I mean, it's really rather pathetic to be fooled by that, I think.
Hmm. And, you know, you were saying my high school friend thought that God talked to him. So does my president.
Yes. your president is told by God to invade Iraq. And by the way, it's a pity God didn't tell him there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Right. I wish God had been more specific also. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, sitting in for Susie Wiseman, speaking with Richard Dawkins, and he is the author of The God Delusion, international bestseller, and we're talking about the questions raised in that book. And for more information, you can visit www.richarddawkins.net. The argument from Scripture, how do you deal with that one?
Well, there are lots and lots of Scriptures all around the world, and they contradict each other. There's really no reason to suppose that just because something's written down, it's true. You have to ask who wrote it and when and why. What reason did they have to write down what they wrote? If you actually ask somebody, why do you believe that your scripture is the word of God? The answer that comes back is, oh, because it says so here. And you say, well, where does it say so? And they say, in my scripture. So the Holy Scripture, whichever it is, the Quran or the Bible or the Book of Mormon, says within itself that it is the word of God, which is a circular argument and not to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. And let me go back for a second to the one about the personal experience, and you mentioned about dreams and so on. Where does the recent scientific conversation about the nodule in the brain or, some of these phenomena that people have talked about, where does that fit into that question?
There is a certain amount of evidence that certain parts of the brain do have something to do with so-called religious experience. One particular example which I've had experience of is the work of the Canadian neurophysiologist Michael Persinger, who tries to mimic the effects of temporal lobe epilepsy using magnetic fields, which he passes through the brain. And if he passes magnetic fields through certain parts of the brain, in about 80% of subjects, he can induce religious experiences or mystical experiences. The details of the religious experience depend upon how the person was brought up. So if the person was Catholic, they tend to see Virgin Marys or whatever it might be, and so on. In my case, it didn't work. I turned out to be one of the 20% for whom it didn't work. But if it had worked for me, I probably wouldn't have seen any gods, but I probably would have experienced some sort of oneness with the universe or some sort of mystical experience of that sort.
Well, so, yes, jumping off from that, how universal is the belief in a supernatural God?
It's universal in the anthropological sense that all human cultures that anthropologists have looked at seem to have something corresponding to a belief in some sort of God. The details vary, of course. Sometimes it's many gods, sometimes it's one, sometimes it's a sort of animistic set of gods, the god of the waterfall, the god of the river, the god of the mountain, the sun god. The details vary, but it does seem to be a human universal in the same sort of way as heterosexual lust is a human universal, even though not all individual humans have it.
And how do you explain its prevalence, sir? And is the evolution of scientific thought a factor in where that might go in the days forward?
Well, when you ask a Darwinian like me how you explain something, what he usually takes that to mean, what is the Darwinian survival value of it? I don't know whether that's what you meant.
It's fair enough, because I'm asking what you think explains it.
If it's, as I think it is, like sexual lust, there's a kind of lust for gods, then I think that it doesn't necessarily have a survival value in itself. But the idea that I put forward in, I think it's chapter 6 of The God Delusion, is that it's a byproduct of something else. Quite often when you ask, what is the survival value of X, it turns out that you shouldn't be asking the question about X at all, but that X is itself a byproduct of something else which does have survival value. So in this case, the suggestion I put forward, it's only one of many possible suggestions, is that religious faith is a byproduct of the childhood tendency to believe what your parents tell you. It's a very good idea for children to believe what their parents tell them, because a child who disbelieved what his parents told them would probably die by jumping into the fire or something, by not heeding the parents' advice not to get into the fire. So child brains, on this theory, are born with a rule of thumb, believe what your parents tell you. Now, the problem with that, and where the byproduct idea comes in, is that it's not possible to design a brain that believes what its parents tell it, because that's a good thing to do, without believing bad things along with good things. I mean, if it were obvious how the child brain should filter good advice, like don't jump in the fire, from bad advice, like worship the tribal gods, whatever they happen to be, the child brain has no way of discriminating those two kinds of advice, and so inevitably a child brain that is pre-programmed to obey what its parents and believe what its parents tell it is automatically vulnerable to bad advice, like worship the tribal juju. And so I think that's one part of the answer, but then you need another part of the answer, which is, why do some kinds of bad advice, like worship the tribal juju, survive and others not?
Mm-hmm.
Then you come into things like, oh, well, beliefs like life after death are simply appealing. They spread because they're appealing, because a lot of people don't like the idea of dying and rather do like the idea that they'll survive their own death. And so the meme, if you like, it spreads like a virus because people want to believe it.
Okay, so it's putting those two things together.
Urge
to have some meaning or some explanation or some defiance of death,
yes.
And then with the thing of parental childhood.
Now
might be a moment for, I will ask you, you make quite a point in the present day culture of this children taking on the thoughts of their parents. And I think you've even said that it's almost a civil rights issue that a child should not be called a Catholic child, a Muslim child, a Jewish child.
Yes. We're back to consciousness raising. I'm very, very keen on the idea that children should be not labeled. Consciousness raising, as in the feminist, perhaps we haven't talked about it. It's a thing I talk about so much that I assumed that we had. The feminists raised our consciousness about use of language, you know, in all sorts of ways, and I don't want to get into that, but you know what I mean. Things like saying his or hers instead of just his. In the same way, I think we need to raise consciousness about the labeling of children as this is a Christian child or this is a Jewish child or this is a Muslim child. And I do think it's a civil rights issue. I think it's a matter of child abuse. I'm not saying that parents shouldn't influence their children. That would be hopelessly unrealistic. Obviously, parents would expect to influence their children in all sorts of ways. I mean, you learn your language, you learn the language of your parents, etc. But I think religion is more or less unique in being licensed to confer a label on a child. You never talk about a Republican child or a postmodernist child. You never make the assumption that because a professor of postmodernist literature has a child, that therefore that will be a postmodernist child. It would be ridiculous to do that. And yet, if it's a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim who has a child, or a pair of them, then the whole of society goes along with the idea that you can label this child a Jewish child, a Christian child, a Muslim child. And I do think that that is a form of child abuse. I do think it's a civil rights issue, yes.
And you would say, I would assume, that the choice of how you believe the universe happened or whether there is a God is a choice that, I remember when I was young, the catechism had a term called the age of reason, that one cannot actually take on for oneself until one has reached a certain level of reason, and yet this labeling and this assumption violates that.
Yes, it does. I don't want to be trapped into trying to lay down when that age of reason is. I don't really feel I need to specify that after the age of 16 or after the age of 14 or something, it's okay to suddenly start calling a child a Catholic child or a Protestant child. I think it's a messier thing than that. What I am sure is that when a child is 3 or 4, then it is grotesque to label the child by the opinions about cosmology and humanity and morality of its parents.
Many suggest that you and other atheists, perhaps especially scientists who are atheists, neglect phenomena that you cannot explain. For example, the subjective experience many claim to receive from their belief or their relationship with God, a significant things such as meaning or comfort or inspiration. Now, if millions experience such things, is this not evidence for the existence of the source to which they attribute them? And if not, clarify why it isn't. And where I'm really getting here is a lot of people say religion or belief in God gives people something that you're taking away from them and science doesn't give it.
Yes. Well, I've already, I think, dealt with the alleged personal experience
right.
of God. But you also mentioned comfort and consolation. And clearly this is very important. There's no question about it that people do get comfort and consolation from religion. I mean, if you've just lost a loved one who's died, well, of course it's comforting to feel that they're still there, perhaps somewhere up there looking down on you and caring for you still, and you're going to see them again one day. I mean, that, of course, is wonderfully comforting. But unfortunately, what is comforting isn't necessarily true. And it is sort of intellectual cowardice, I think, to say, oh, well, because something's comforting, therefore, the worst thing of all to say, because it's comforting, it's therefore true. And it's slightly less bad to say, because something's comforting, we should let people wallow in their illusions because it comforts them. I think that's something, the only thing wrong with that is that it's rather patronizing. It's sort of saying, well, you and I know that this is an illusion, but nevertheless, people seem to find it comforting.
You know, one thing I'm thinking of is when their families or even doctors debate whether to tell someone their cancer is terminal.
Well, that's a very good parallel.
Because life is terminal.
Yes, life is terminal. I mean, there are people who would rather not be told the truth by a doctor, and I respect that. That's fine, but that doesn't make it true. The fact that you want your doctor to tell you that you haven't got terminal cancer and your doctor obliges by lying to you, that's fine. But the fact is, he has lied to you. Similarly, you may be comforted by the thought that there's a God looking after you, but if there isn't a God looking after you, then I'm afraid there isn't one, and that's all there is to it. So I don't want to impose my beliefs on anybody else, but I do care about what's true. If you want to know what I think is true, read my book. If you'd rather not know what I think is true, don't read my book.
One of the things that I notice in the critiques of you, of your book, and some others, is, I mean, really where I've noticed, you know, three or four pages, and it seems like their main critique is, well, they criticize you or science on the grounds that you can't answer some of the biggest questions either, and you are unwilling or unable to offer those things we just talked about. So leaving aside the validity of their claims, is it fair to respond to your book or your arguments by pointing out insufficiencies of science?
Well, let's look at those things that science can't answer. There are some questions that science not only can't answer but doesn't want to answer, things like what is right and what is wrong, or how shall we be comforted, something like that. Science has nothing to say about right or wrong. Moral philosophy does. The nearest approach to a scientific approach to morality is sectarian moral philosophy. But there's another whole category of questions that science may not be able to answer, which is the really deep questions of existence, like why is there something rather than nothing, or where did the laws of physics come from in the first place? And it's an open question at the moment whether science will ever be able to answer questions like that. There are certainly questions at present that science can't answer, and they're working on it. Physicists in particular are working on those questions like where do the laws of physics come from. But the glaring fallacy is to say because science can't answer such a question, therefore religion can. Much more realistic would be to say, well, if science can't answer that deep question, nothing can.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question really for my listeners, which is that in America we hear that we are far more provincial and religious than so many other peoples, that much of Europe, even the Roman Catholic countries of Spain and Italy, for instance, are far more secular. Yet your book and your Channel 4 program were originally produced in and for the UK. Is the UK also an exception, or is religion on a rise throughout the world?
I don't think religion is on a rise throughout the world. And as for America, there's no doubt that there is a tendency for religion to hold political power. But I'm not sure that, I suspect that the grip that religion is alleged to have over America has been exaggerated. And I suspect that if people who are not religious would only recognize that they are not the beleaguered minority they think they are, but actually are exceedingly numerous and potentially very powerful, if they would stand up and recognize each other and organize in the way that other much smaller lobbies have done, that they would soon give the lie to this idea that America is a supremely religious country. I think there's been a kind of hijacking of American political life by religious interests. And what I think is rather sad is the way the intellectual segment of American politics has sort of gone along with that. And so even intelligent Democrats, you'll see them desperately currying favor with the religious vote because they think the religious vote is so powerful. I think an awful lot of that goes on, and I was mentioning that earlier. No member of Congress will admit to being an atheist, although obviously some of them are.
Yeah, I think in polls we see that among law-abiding people, the person that people are less likely in polls to say they would vote for an important political office is an atheist. They're much more likely to vote, just for instance, for a homosexual or Muslim,
That's what polls are suggesting. And so in a way, it's no wonder politicians are scared of it.
Right. I don't think you can ask too many of the politicians to move first. I think what you're saying is the people have to
come out of the closet.
Have
to come out of the closet and have to write to their congressmen and congresswomen and say, look, stop sucking up to the religious vote. We exist too. Suck up to us for a change. Or better still, don't suck up to anybody, but speak your own convictions.
there's a good call. How about the fact that we've talked about religion offering comfort and so on? What about it as a moralizing force or a civilizing force? And I'm going to ask this in two ways. First, I'm going to say that when I spoke with a member of the Ashwar tribe in the Amazon forest, whose tribe had its first contact with the modern world in the 70s, okay? And I said, so how do you feel about the missionaries? And I assumed he would say, oh, bad folks, you know? He said, until the missionaries came, we killed each other all the time. It was they were the ones who stopped us from killing each other and having that be the main way we dealt with each other. I've also done some analysis of the founding fathers, and in which I'm out, you know, to say, were they really, you know, Christian or deist or theist? But one of the things that some of them do say is, although they weren't, they felt the people needed religion, that once you took away the monarchy or the papacy, that what people, that people did need religion kind of to behave as a moral society. What do you think of that? And then finally, how is religion as a moralizing force?
There's something awfully patronizing and condescending, isn't there, about saying, well, of course, we don't need religion, but the common people out there do. I hope it's not as bad as that. I would wish that we didn't have to be that patronizing. Now, the point about the missionaries being a civilizing influence on tribes whose habit was to kill each other, presumably, if the first contact they had had with Westerners had not been with missionaries, but with policemen, they would have said, oh, well, if, until the policemen came, we killed each other. The fact is that any contact with the outer world civilization, where through centuries of change we have now reduced our natural tendency to kill each other, we now have police forces, we now outlaw murder, whereas there are some tribes in the Amazon jungle, for example, where killing is the norm and the way to achieve worldly success. In our society, we talk about making a killing on Wall Street, and the equivalent of that in an Amazon tribe might be literally to go and kill sexual rivals, for example. Well, that changes when such tribes are brought into contact with Western civilization. It just so happens that the people who go out of their way to bring Western civilization to such tribes usually are missionaries. That doesn't mean that it's the religion that has fostered the thou shalt not kill point of view. Thou shalt not kill is a general moral principle which we all have whether or not we are religious, and that brings me to your third.
Right, exactly. That's what I was going to say. Some people will claim that without religion, people in modern society would claim that without religion, we would not act morally, we would not have ethics.
That's an appalling thing to say, isn't it? Because it suggests that the only reason why we act morally, the only reason why we don't kill and rape and steal, is that we're afraid of being found out by God. We're afraid that God is watching us. We're afraid of the great surveillance camera in the sky. Now, that's not a very noble reason for being good. There is, as a matter of fact, not the slightest evidence that religious people in a given society are any more moral than non-religious people. We are, all of us, in the modern world, far more reluctant to kill, reluctant to discriminate against other people on grounds of sex. We no longer regard slavery as a good thing. All these things have changed in society and are universally approved of among educated people of goodwill in modern society, whether or not they are religious. And if you look at the reforms that have taken place, for example, the abolition of slavery, you can point to individuals like Wilberforce who happen to be religious, and you can point to other individuals who were in favor of slavery, who were also religious. It doesn't look as though religion has a lot to do with the shifting moral zeitgeist, which has seen to it that modern morality is very different from the truly horrifying version of morality that they had, for example, in the Old Testament. We have moved on since those days, and the thing that has moved us on is some kind of complicated mixture of secular moral philosophy, of legal court cases, of conversations, of all kinds of things that have moved us on so that we no longer treat slavery as a good thing, not because of religious reasons. If we went by the Bible, we'd still be taking slaves. If we went by the Bible, we'd still be stoning people to death for the crime of picking up sticks on the Sabbath. There are all sorts of ways in which we've moved on, and nobody who claims to get their religion from, sorry, who claims to get their morality from religion could seriously maintain that they get it from Scripture.
And that is your injunction, let's say, to moderate Christians, moderate Jews, moderate Muslims, that you don't, you think there's a problem with them as well. And what is that?
Well, here I take this largely from Sam Harris in his two excellent books, Letter to a Christian Nation and The End of Faith. He points out, and I agree with him, that although the majority of religious people are perfectly nice people who don't do horrible things, yet moderate religion makes the world safe for extremist religion by teaching that religious faith is a virtue, by teaching, we had this a little bit earlier in our conversation, the immunity that religion enjoys to criticism. And that immunity extends to extremists like Osama bin Laden and that dreadful man who goes around saying God hates fags. I've forgotten his name. You perhaps know it.
Well, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, the list goes
all
on.
That, oh, yeah, those types. The world is made safe for people like them and Osama bin Laden because we've all of us been brainwashed to respect religious faith and not to criticize it with the same vigor as we criticize political opinions and other sorts of opinions that we disagree with. So if you can say, well, such and such a view is part of my religion, everybody tiptoes away with great respect and says, oh, it's part of your religion, then of course you must go ahead. And with major extremes like suicide bombers and blowing up skyscrapers in planes, we don't do that. But in a way, we've been asking for trouble by giving to moderate religion, by moderate people giving to, persuading us to give to all religion, a respect which it has never done anything to deserve.
Okay, I'm going to quote actually someone from whom you quoted, which is physicist Steven Weinberg, appropriate to what you just said. I thought it was quite strong. He says, religion is an insult to human dignity. Without it, you'd have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. For good people to do evil things, it takes religion. And let me just leave that as the addendum to the last answer. And let me finally, as we come to the end, I've noticed that you finished the book and you speak about your own experience of awe and transcendence. It's actually how you start the book as well, in the wonders of existence. And you write eloquently about this in Unweaving the Rainbow, a previous book, and you publish an excerpt, I notice, with the title, To Be Read at My Funeral. You have a couple of minutes now. Could you speak about that part of your experience?
Yes. Unweaving the Rainbow, which I wrote, I think, in 1998, was my answer to those people who say that science, and in particular my worldview of the selfish gene and so on, was cold and bleak and loveless. And so the opening words of Unweaving the Rainbow, which I've set aside and asked should be read at my funeral, maybe I could just read a few words from that.
Very well.
We are going to die, and that makes us the lucky ones. Most people are never going to die because they're never going to be born. The potential people who could have been here in my place but who will in fact never see the light of day outnumber the sand grains of Sahara. And then I'll leave out a bit. In the teeth of these stupefying odds, it is you and I in our ordinariness that are here. Here's another respect in which we are lucky. The universe is older than 100 million centuries. Within a comparable time, the sun will swell to a red giant and engulf the earth. Every century of hundreds of millions has been in its time, or will be when its time comes, the present century. The present moves from the past to the future like a tiny spotlight inching its way along a gigantic ruler of time. Everything behind the spotlight is in darkness, the darkness of the dead past. Everything ahead of the spotlight is in the darkness of the unknown future. The odds of your centuries being the one in the spotlight are the same as the odds that a penny tossed down at random will land on a particular ant crawling somewhere along the road from New York to San Francisco. You are lucky to be alive, and so am I. We are lucky to be alive, and therefore we should value life. Life is precious. We're never going to get another one. This is it. Don't waste it. Open your eyes, open your ears, treasure the experiences that you have, and don't waste your time fussing about a non-existent future life after you're dead. Try to do as much good as you can now to others. Try to live life as far as possible, as richly as possible, during the time that you have left available to you.
Well, thank you, Richard Dawkins. The book is The God Delusion. The website is richarddawkins.net. Richard Dawkins, thank you for this time, and if I may, Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you, too.